Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Happy New Year, everyone. A couple of things about the legacy of Gerald Ford. Not only did he never say drop dead to New York City, he actually approved big federal loans to the city during the 1970s fiscal crisis. And despite his nice guy reputation, well earned in many ways, he did have an episode as a leading edge conservative culture warrior before the term culture wars even came into vogue, when he spearheaded an impeachment attempt against a liberal Supreme Court Justice, William O. Douglas. So we'll talk about those and a few other lesser discussed points of the Ford legacy now with two guests. John Robert Green is a biographer of Gerald Ford. His book is called The Presidency of Gerald Ford, published by the University Press of Kansas. He teaches history at Cazenovia College. Do you know your New York State geography? Cazenovia College, about 20 miles east of Syracuse. And the Daily News Washington Bureau Chief, Tom DeFrank. He interviewed Ford dozens of times, and we are getting Tom DeFrank up on a better line than he was on a minute ago. So, Professor Green, welcome to WNYC.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
We think of Gerald Ford today as moderate, as the accidental president who didn't really seek power. But these things weren't always true. He was House Minority Leader. He chaired the Republican conventions that nominated Nixon in 68 and 72. So he was a Republican leader, activist, wasn't he?
Absolutely. In 63, the younger moderates in the party were trying to take a stand against the onrush of Goldwater conservatism, and they pushed Ford to run for chair of the House GOP conference, and he won over a senior member of the House, Hoven of Iowa. And after Goldwater was defeated, Ford was able to ride that wave of disgust against the conservatives to the minority leader position as he ousted, with the help of Don Rumsfeld, actually the point help of Don Rumsfeld, Charlie Halleck as minority leader. So by 1965, he is the leading Republican on Capitol Hill, a position that he would hold until he took vice president in 1973.
So a moderate Republican activist in opposition to Goldwater arch-conservatism of its day?
At that moment, yes. But Ford is was a conservative with a small c, and you made reference to probably one of the most interesting episode while Ford was on the Hill, one which in many ways runs counter to the interview given to Bob Woodward that's getting a lot of play in the press right now, and that's the on-again, off-again hate affair with Bill Douglas.
Tell us about that quest to impeach a liberal Supreme Court justice. Why did he launch that drive?
Well, Ford didn't like the liberal philosophy or the liberal lifestyle of Justice William Douglas, and for a number of reasons. Douglas had taken money for an article in a magazine called Evergreen that also published softcore porn, and that offended Ford. But even more so, Douglas was the president and director, paid president and director of a foundation with limits to with links to Meyer Lansky, a gangster. And Ford started an investigation of Douglas's background. Ford didn't want to impeach Douglas. He wanted to force Douglas to resign.
Hmm.
But what this did was it linked with Richard Nixon's court problems. If you'll remember, Abe Fortas had resigned from the court under a cloud, and Nixon was trying to get through Clement Haynsworth to replace Fortas, and Haynsworth had a laundry list of problems he was going to run up against in the Senate. And so
And then there was another one, I forget his name, but two in a row conservative Supreme Court nominees by Nixon got shot down by Congress.
And before Carswell came on, however, then you're talking about Harold Carswell, right. G. Harold Carswell, Nixon may well have worked with Ford to hold the Douglas hostage for a Haynesworth appointment. And there's a little bit of evidence on this. It didn't work because, as you suggest, the Haynesworth nomination was shot down by Congress, and Nixon gave them, in disgust, a complete incompetent and a completely unqualified judge in G. Harold Carswell. And Nixon went through an intermediary to tell Ford to speed up his inquiry. Ford didn't want to impeach, but Nixon was so furious with Congress that he was going to take away from those Democrats a liberal justice, and he told Ford to speed up his inquiry, and Ford didn't want to do it.
So Ford was doing Nixon's bidding. Who ultimately got that open seat at that time?
The open seat went to, now I'm blanking, and I'm looking right at him, Harry Blackmun.
Oh, Harry Blackmun.
Ford put in Harry Blackmun. Now I'm blanking on the name of the guy who got this.
Tom DeFrank, do you happen to remember?
No.
That's a tough. I think it was one of those seats. I should know this, too.
This is a test early in the morning.
That's right. I think it's one of those seats that the Republicans were ultimately came to regret because the person voted with you know who knows. Was it Lewis Powell?
Lewis Powell.
So it was someone who they came to regret, at least in an ideological sense. So, but before we go to Ford to City, just finish the thought on this impeachment quest. Did that begin the modern era of extreme partisanship over Supreme Court justices, or did it just continue it?
No, it just continued it, because Ford tried to pull back from all of this with a speech on the floor. He just wanted a select committee to investigate. He was not doing Nixon's bidding. In fact, he tried not to do Nixon's bidding. The Democrats tried to move to impeach Douglas, to put Nixon in a corner and put him in a hard place. Nixon ordered Ford finally to back off of the impeachment, and Ford did with pleasure. I think one of the things that is missed in this, in the Woodward piece, is you hear Ford being very political on those tapes. I'll be interested to know what Mr. DeFrank thinks about it, but there was no love lost between those two men. They were not close drinking buddies by any stretch of the imagination.
You mean Ford and Nixon?
Ford and Nixon, and the Douglas episode showed Ford as minority leader trying desperately to stay out of the way of the White House and to do what he thought was best.
Interesting. Well, Tom DeFrank, I'll bring you in on that, but let me have you give our listeners a little bit of background on the relationship between you and Gerald Ford. I understand that you, as a Daily News correspondent and now Washington bureau chief, have interviewed him literally dozens of times. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And how did that come to be?
Let me tell you a little bit about the relationship. I covered him when he was vice president. I was assigned to cover him as vice president, and I traveled with him constantly from December of 1973 to August of 1974 when he became president. I went to the White House and covered him there. And after he left the White House, for the last 30 years, I've gone out to see him in Colorado or California at least once a year. And I've had three dozen interviews with him after he left the White House. And some people have described it as a close personal relationship. I don't think that's correct, but I would describe it as a very strong
You know what? We're having terrible problems with your cell phone there, Tom. We're going to put you on hold and see if we can get this right. In the meantime, we'll continue with John Robert Green, biographer Gerald Ford. His book is called The Presidency of Gerald Ford, published by the University Press of Kansas. He teaches history at Cazenovia College, east of Syracuse. Let's see, where else can we go? You know where you mentioned that Don Rumsfeld was the point man to get Gerald Ford elected minority leader in opposition to the Goldwater conservative camp in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
What was Don Rumsfeld in 1963? What was his job? What did he do?
He was a congressman from Illinois. And at that time, he was one of the Young Turks who was very influential in terms of trying to moderate the Republican Party after the Goldwater debacle, and Rumsfeld was even more important in January of 1965 when Ford ousted Halleck as minority leader. The relationship between those two men began, you know, that early and that strongly. And
Rumsfeld went on to be one of the White House chiefs of staff during the Ford administration, and Dick Cheney was the other one.
That's correct. When Rumsfeld was also in charge of the transition from the Nixon to the Ford administration, a transition which was about 30 seconds long. But Rumsfeld had put together some briefing books for Ford. Ford did not want to be seen as trying to push Nixon out of the way in August of 1974 by having an open transition, so he trusted Rumsfeld to do it in secret. He brought Rumsfeld in as his chief of staff after trying originally a White House without a chief of staff, and it turned into a Barnum and Bailey free-for-all with a staff that just didn't work and play well with each other. And he brought Rumsfeld in to clean that up, which he did, and Rumsfeld brought Cheney along as his deputy.
But again, as a New York liberal might see it in 2006, Ford had this reputation as a moderate, but these two protégés or close allies of his, you know, became these two fire-breathing neocons. Was there more to them at that time that would have indicated something like this, or more to the relationship with Ford that had the seeds of this?
No, in fact, it was quite the opposite. You were dealing with a White House in 1974 who was wedded to détente, who was committed to finishing out Richard Nixon's policy of normalizing relations with the Soviet Union and with the People's Republic of China. As Defense Secretary, Rumsfeld showed absolutely no indication of what he would become. In fact, in terms of the episodes where one might have expected that to happen, like the Mayaguez episode, Rumsfeld is one of the moderating voices. It's quite possible, although I'm not a psycho historian, and you know, speculation is the mother of all gossip shows. I think that they became what they became in terms of the fire-breathing neocons around the period of the Gulf War, because they had been out. They had been cut, Cheney and Rumsfeld, frozen out of the Reagan administration. And when they come back in the Bush administration, they come back with a vengeance.
Because they were seen as too soft, too pro-détente
for
Ronald Reagan.
It's distinctly possible.
Yeah. All right, we have Tom DeFrank, Washington Bureau Chief for the Daily News, back with us. And Tom, give us the genesis of that perhaps most famous of all Daily News headlines, Ford to City Drop Dead. Whoops. Boy, are we having terrible
phone problems. I think that's what happened
problems.
With his line.
Yeah, well, and this is a landline in a hotel that he's in, so I don't know. We may have to give Tom DeFrank a rain check. But John Robert Green, biographer Gerald Ford, I will continue with you and ask you this. In recent years, recent decades, really, Ford and Jimmy Carter became close, even though Carter was the one who ousted Ford. How did that start?
It started on a plane to Anwar Sadat's funeral, and when Ford and Carter were put onto that plane to go to the funeral, neither one of them really at that point in time wanted to go if the other one was going to go, but they were both talked into it by all reports by their wives, who said that this was a genuine moment of reclamation, that Ronald Reagan wanted them to go and represent the country. And on the plane with Richard Nixon,
Nixon, Ford, and Carter were all there.
They genuinely hit it off. And from that moment on, they formed not the bond that you see between the first President Bush and President Clinton, which is a very public, arm around the shoulder, almost good old boy, you know, we hate each other behind closed doors, so we love each other in public type bond. That was a very subtle bond of respect. And for these two men who genuinely disliked each other in 1976, disliked each other on a personal level and whose wives disliked each other on an even more visceral level, for them to gain the respect for each other that they did, and they did things quietly at each other's libraries. They appeared on a lot of panels, a lot of academic panels, and more importantly, they spoke with respect for each other. Neither one of them, by the way, spoke with the same amount of respect for Ronald Reagan.
So a disdain for Ronald Reagan was a unifying bond?
That's what's been written the last couple of days. I have no firsthand evidence of that, but I know that that President Ford had that kind of disdain for Ronald Reagan. And that's why the 1980 episode where he decides that he's willing to run for super vice president with Ronald Reagan at the head of the ticket is so difficult to explain. But that moment of jumping back into the water aside, there was no love lost between the Reagan and the Ford camps.
Did that persist years after Reagan became so popular?
Yes, it did. In fact, some would argue that it persisted because of that. Remember, in 1976, Reagan runs against Ford for the nomination, and there were virtually everyone in the Ford camp believed that that strong run by Reagan, where he comes up only about 36 or 37 votes short of the nomination, cost Ford the election because it cost so much money, cost so much time, didn't allow them to position themselves against Carter very well. And Reagan did not campaign for Ford virtually at all during the fall campaign, didn't bring the conservatives home, and his speech at the convention was the Reaganites point to that as the first moment of Ronald Reagan's campaign for the 1980 election. It was ignored Gerald Ford completely, and the Ford people never forgot it. Throughout the Reagan administration, they marginalized themselves.
A caller reminds us, by the way, that Donald Rumsfeld wasn't completely frozen out of the Reagan administration. He had that famous photographed handshake with Saddam Hussein as an envoy from Reagan in, I think, 1983.
And that was and Rumsfeld was also working as a consultant at that point in time. When I interviewed him for my book on Bush, I believe he was working as a consultant out of Chicago.
And so went to Baghdad for Reagan as a what?
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, okay.
I wasn't aware of that.
So, but
that
he
doesn't
did.
Make it not true, though.
Yeah, no, it's certainly true because it's been documented, and it certainly was then, and it's been, you know, thrown up in the Republicans' face and in Rumsfeld's face during the war, and when people say that, you know, Saddam
had delusions of becoming president
Rumsfeld
at that time, and several times had entered, at least once, entered the ring, I think it was in 1988, for the Republican nomination for the presidency.
Last thing, we have about 30 seconds. One little piece of minutia from the Ford legacy. His gaffe in the presidential debate with Jimmy Carter in 76, where he said there's no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, was it just a slip of the tongue, or did he really not know
about
the Soviet bloc?
It was a complete slip of the tongue. I've seen a tape of a warm-up, a practice for the debate. They knew they were going to get that question because of the Sonnenfeld doctrine. He was ready for it. What he wanted to say was that the Poles did not accept and would never philosophically accept domination, spiritually, philosophically, politically, of the Soviet Union, which was a correct answer. But what he said and what he slipped was, you know, that the Soviets weren't there.
Yeah.
More importantly, when given the chance to correct himself, he said the same thing twice.
About Poland.
Yes.
John Robert Green, biographer of Gerald Ford. His book is called The Presidency of Gerald Ford, published by the University Press of Kansas. He teaches history at Cazenovia College, upstate New York. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And coming up next, our end-of-year news quiz with Gail Collins from The Times. Stay with us. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.